You, me, or nobody is gonna hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done.
Everybody gets hurt. Either metaphorically, symbolically, or physically, they get hurt. And you root for that person who gets hurt. Get up! Because we all get knocked down. And that's just a credo I've followed my whole life.
Life is undefeated. You can't beat it.
What's the matter with you? There is no tomorrow.
You just have to go on the defense. That inspired the line, no one punches harder than life.
I felt that, geez, if I was going to go down into professional obscurity, I wanted to at least have the opportunity to say to myself, well, you tried.
It dawned on me that we basically are in a movie from the time we're born. And then when you get to be around 18, 20, you're now the director of your movie, which is called Life. And I ask you, knowing that if you were in a movie of your own making, would you be proud of the part you're playing? I certainly wasn't. And I took drastic steps to change all that. The point being, if you're producing this film called You, make it the way you want to make it. And to really progress, old skin must be shed before a new skin can grow. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's pretty much the truth. If you don't like this skin, rip it off and become a different character. I was raised by a very physical father, you know, I mean. So I was no stranger to serious pain. And I think it just became, I'm not gonna break. No matter what he did, you know, I'm just not going to break. I had a very tumultuous upbringing. Rough father, rough everything. And I was thin. I just was not genetically, would you say, a mesomorph? I was an ectomorph. And I went to see a film one day, and it altered my life completely. It was Steve Reeves in Hercules Unchained. And when he struck that pose, I had an epiphany. I went, that's who I want to be. That's a man. That's, oh my God. And I ran out of the theater after that and went to a junkyard and started lifting little like brake drums or anything that I could lift. It was like 30 pounds, whatever. And I never stopped. And I did build on armor. It was like, I felt I could really take care of myself. I could inflict punishment rather than take punishment. And I never stopped. Always had hero worship. You know, I wish I could be the guy who saved the bus full of children. That's who I want to be. I want to be the guy who saves people.
I think everybody here, put under the right circumstances, their children or their wife or in dire trouble, put their life on the line. I don't give you a kid falls in a tire cage. You wouldn't think twice about jumping in. So everyone has the hero syndrome in them. They do. You just have to push the right button.
I used to sit in this little apartment, and it was a room. As a matter of fact, the room was so small, I remember I was able to open up the window and close the door while sitting on the bed at the same time. It was like 8 feet by 9 feet. But the one thing about that room, there was really very little distraction.
And he painted the windows black so he could write.
I did paint them black because I didn't want to know what time it didn't matter what time it was. Oh, it's time for breakfast. Right away, you derailed yourself. I'll have breakfast when I'm hungry. I don't need to know what time it is, that kind of thing. So I was trying to eliminate all the excuses because it's hard to write.
So I would sit there propped up in bed, and I'd go out with my big pen and legal pad and just start writing these stories. And most of them were very, very trivial. But there was something about the process of unrealized dreams. I was always brought back to this subject because I think it's one of the most enduring subjects and one of the most difficult passages for people to accept that they never were realized in their own lifetime, that they just didn't get that shot. The more I thought about this kind of street-like character that that just is totally misrepresented by the way he looks physically. Just the way he walks down the street was enough to say people, oh, dismiss him. He's kind of looks like a bully or looks like a dark kind of character. And I thought, you know, that's an interesting character because they're always unrealized. Well, that festered in my mind for quite a while, and then eventually I decided it was a time to come to California. So I went to California, and I moved in the Valley, and things weren't going very, very well there. As a matter of fact, I had to try to sell my dog because it was either do that or he just was not going to be very well fed around the house.
I did sell my dog at a 7-Eleven. It was either that or eat him. I mean,
And then one night, I went to see a Muhammad Ali fight. And what I saw was pretty extraordinary. I saw a man they called the Bayonne Bleeder who didn't have a chance at all against, you know, the greatest fighting machine, supposedly, that ever lived.
Brought his back, slips a punch to his left. Oh, a vicious shot to the rib of Muhammad Ali, and what a surprise! Chuck Webner gets to the body.
And for one brief moment, this supposed stumblebum turned out to be magnificent in the fact that he lasted and knocked the champion down. I said, boy, if this isn't a metaphor for life, his entire life crystallized at that moment. He will be remembered for all eternity, at least among the fight fans. He did something extraordinary. I said, now that is probably what I need as a catalyst for an idea, a man who's going to stand up to life and take one shot and maybe go the distance.
It really don't matter if I lose this fight. It really don't matter if this guy opens my head either. So all I want to do is go to distance.
So I started to write. And it was one of those writing frenzies. And 3 days later, I came up with the script of Rocky.
At that time, I must admit, my life was definitely on the wane, at least professionally. I was emotionally, spiritually, physically bankrupt. I had about $106 in the bank. I had a landlord. She's a female landlord. But she was so big that when she came to collect the rent, like an entire shadow would cover the building. You know what I mean? It's like a total eclipse. And, I mean, I'm not a small man, but she was a vicious individual, and she would have thought nothing about taking my car and bending it in half if she didn't get her money. And so I had $106. The rent was $300. I had a pregnant wife. So you might say I had quite a bit of fuel to sit down and write the script. I wrote the script in about 3.5 days, and only because I could hear the wolf at the door, literally.
But here's the caveat. I'd say 90% was terrible. I believe in getting something done, no matter how flawed, just to get to the finish line.
Just to get it out.
Just to get it out. Because I find that procrastination and diversion is something that writers revel in. Oh, I hope that phone rings. You know what I mean? Hope someone invites me to the beach. Because, or, let me see, what would I rather do, play golf or sit at this desk continually reminding myself of how stupid I am because I can't come up with an idea. Yeah. So
it's
I
angst.
Feel for writers. Now, the script by no means was a finished piece of material. It was probably about 90 pages, and maybe 10% of it remained in the final script, but it was done. I was on a casting call. So we're talking a little bit, and I guess I really wasn't right for the acting part. And on the way out, I said, oh, I don't know if it matters, but I do a little bit of writing. He goes, really? I said, yeah, I'm writing this story, I have this thing about wrestlers, and I might do something about boxing. Well, he says, well, bring it around. And I thought, if I hadn't stopped on the way out, you know, that's why I tell all actors or writers, don't give up, keep talking. Eventually, you might hit a nerve somewhere, and they go, ah, come on back. And if they didn't say, come on back, or bring it later, and let's see what you've developed, I wouldn't be sitting here. So I have to give incredible credit to their insight and their patience. And they're willing to take a chance, which it doesn't exist much anymore, unfortunately. Originally, when I brought the script to them, they were fairly enthusiastic about it. The one thing they were not enthusiastic about was me playing the part, and I really can't blame them. At the time, Ryan O'Neill was a candidate, Burt Reynolds, Robert Redford, Jimmy Kahn, and they all were at the top of their game. And so I could see it, but there was something inside of me that you know, this opportunity is never going to come around. And I really wasn't used to money, and I had no idea of what I would be missing. But the temptation started to come forward. First, it was $25,000, then $100,000. I never heard of $100,000 because I had like 106 dollars in the bank. And like I said, I had to sell my dog, and things were not looking very, very good. My $40 car had just blown up, so I was taking a bus to work. And but still, it didn't matter. I wanted to stick with it. Then it went up to $150,000, $175,000, then it went up to $250,000, and it went up to $360,000. Now my head was starting to spin.
Famous story is that you turned down all this money for the screenplay to Rocky because they wouldn't let you, they didn't want you to be in it, right?
No. Can you blame them? Who was I? You know.
What I've never heard you talk about is what is in you to be able to turn that down when you don't have anything. You're broke, man.
I was flat ass broke. I mean, seriously. But it depends how well you know yourself. I knew my personality that if I sold it, that was probably a million plus by today's dollars. A millionaire, and someone else did it, and it was successful, I would have never forgiven myself.
I know in the back of my mind, if I sell this script and it does very, very well, I'm going to jump off a building. And if I'm not in it, there's no doubt about it, I'm going to leap in front of a train. I'm going to be very, very upset.
So I would have been a broken, embittered man for the rest of my life. So I realized we have in our entire futures, about three or four serious crossroads. And that was my first one. That's where a real serious crossroad, where this is life-altering. And it's not about money. I know I will be destroyed, and I will destroy everyone around me. I'll be such a miserable human being for selling out. This is what the whole movie was about, is not selling out.
You knew that it would ruin it.
I just know how I work. I know what my engine will do, but I would have been dead. Because when you're broke, I actually mastered the art of poverty for a while. You know, you figure it out. All right, we have spaghetti one day a week and this and that. I managed, and I still had this blatant optimism. But if I had sold out, oh my God. And I knew it. And they tried. I mean, believe me, they tried.
So this is one of those things where you just roll the dice and you fly by the proverbial seat of your pants and say, all right, I gotta try it. I gotta just do it. I may be totally wrong, and I'm gonna be taking a lot of people down with me, but I just believe in it.
I felt that, geez, if I was gonna go down, at least into professional obscurity, I wanted to at least have the opportunity to say to myself, well, you tried. If nothing else, I had a good home movie. My parents would enjoy it.
What is healthier? To live under the illusion and still have a little glimmer of hope that you could have been great, or actually have an opportunity to be great, and then you blow it and you realize you're a failure. So I think that the easier route is to live under the illusion and say, you know, if I had had that chance, I would have beaten all of them.
Then finally, it was being shown at the Directors Guild, and this was going to be the test. And there was about 900 people invited, and it was a packed crowd, and the movie was playing terribly. My mother was sitting next to me, and the laughs weren't coming where they're supposed to, and the fight itself seemed to be listless, the response was, and I sat there as everyone filed out of the theater, and I couldn't believe it. I said, Ma, I really blew it. It was all like, I don't know, it was nice while it lasted, but I guess when you get down and you show it to the big boys, they're just not buying it. Anyway, I sat there and literally there was no one left in the theater because I was humiliated and saddened by the whole thing. And even, you know, I walked her out and I was walking down the steps and there's three flights down, first flight, second flight. And then by the time I turned for the third flight, the entire audience was down there. There was 900 people waiting, and they started to applaud, and I mean truly applaud. And I said, how could you doubt me, Mom? I'm shocked. And it's like, I just completely came apart. And so there'll never be a moment like that ever. I mean, I truly was over. I said, this is it. I'm just gonna, you know, go back home, take my dog, and go back into, you know, trying to eke out a living. And they were all there. And they responded in a way. It's like, I don't know if that's the way they did things in Hollywood, but they saved it up, and I'll never get over that moment. I just looked at all these people, and they were applauding. And it's been all downhill since. At the very end of our lives, if we can still say, you know, we were never humbled, we were knocked down, but we got up, and I can say, I lived life with integrity, and I took all the blows, as the song says, and I still prevailed. I think that's a good epitaph for anyone.